Hello and welcome to WBAA's Off the Field with Morgan Burke. It's our bi-weekly conversation with Purdue's athletic director about some of the more notable goings-on in sports. If ever you've got a question for this program, please do email it to news@wbaa.org. You can also tweet it to us at WBAA News on Twitter. Well, one of the things, Morgan, we're trying to add to the show is a little bit of a look at some of the athletes that make up the Purdue sports. And one of the ones I think people will think of immediately this week is A.J. Hammons. Had seven blocks against Ohio State that in their third win over a ranked team in their last four games. And this is somebody who has, it's hard to think of someone who's 7 feet tall being someone who overcomes adversity, but someone who was not necessarily completely in the coach's good graces, had been coming off the bench. And, you know, this is somebody who's kind of had to work through some things.
Yeah, it's really, I think, a work in progress, but I think a really good story about a young person and how they develop. People, you know, made the comments a year ago that he seemed unhappy, didn't have a lot of smiles, a lot of energy, a lot of enthusiasm. This year they're seeing quite the opposite. I think what they're seeing is a young guy growing up. And he did very well in class in the fall semester, which I was pleased with. I think when they're doing good in all aspects of their life, they tend to feel confident and probably play in their sports a little better as well. But couldn't be happier for him right now and hope that he continues on that same trajectory. He is a true talent, but he is a really good person if people get to know him. And college has been very, very good to bring out his full personality.
I have watched a number of the men's basketball games this year, and I've sort of been watching the way that Hammons and Haas interact with each other. And I've seen a little bit of both of them off the court after games as they're heading out and I'm heading out. And the term gentle giant seems to apply to both of these guys.
Yeah, they get along. And, you know, sometimes when you have guys that are sharing minutes, it gets to be contentious or it can be a problem in the locker room, and it just has not been. You know, one of the things that this team has kind of picked up on is you've got a better connection between the young men. I've taken a couple of away trips with them, and they just seem to get along. And when teams have that good chemistry, it just seems like they produce a little better in competition. So, but those two big guys, you know, they could beat each other's throats. You know, here's a freshman taking my minutes away, and that hadn't been the case. They kind of, I think Isaac kind of looks up to AJ as a big brother, and AJ kind of embraces him. So it's kind of a fun thing for the fans to watch.
I've seen a couple of fairly funny things too. There was a video early on in the season that they showed of these two guys pulling leaves out of the gutter and kind of making fun that they're so tall. And I saw a photo that was posted to Facebook or Twitter a couple weeks ago of Isaac Haas kind of cramped into this little restaurant diner chair, and the caption was something like, "Isaac looks," and then in quotes, "comfortable." So it's been kind of funny to watch. Another athlete who's made a difference, people may know the name David Bedaya from his Olympic success, but there's another diver on the team right now who is equaling some of the things that David Bedaya did when he was here.
Yeah, Steele Johnson is a freshman out of Carmel, Indiana, and he's already in his short semester and a half been named Big Ten Diver of the Week 6 times in his first year, which is right on par with what Bedaya got. In fact, David, during his entire career, had it 9 times. And the irony is that Steele is David's synchronized diving partner, and they're likely to team up to work to get to the Rio de Janeiro Olympics here in 2016. But this is an extremely talented young man and only a freshman. So Adam Soldati has got a whole group of divers that not only are great in the Big Ten level, but great nationally and internationally.
And this is somebody who's come out of that powerhouse Carmel program that has produced so many good swimmers and divers over the last 2 decades.
Yeah, right? And really the diving, Steele has actually been diving with the Boilermaker Aquatic Club. He's traveled from Carmel up to West Lafayette in order to train with Adam. So there's a little bit of a connection. Adam's done a tremendous job. I don't think diving gets enough publicity. It's not a high-profile sport, but when you look at what some of these kids are doing, they land, they go off that 10-meter platform, they hit the water 30 miles an hour. It's like hitting concrete. If you miss it, you're gonna be one sore person. So it's a tough mental sport, tough physical sport, and Purdue's right at the forefront with all those kids.
This is WBAA's Off the Field with Morgan Burke. Thanks for being with us today. I wanted to get a couple of questions in that I didn't get to you because we ran out of time 2 weeks ago. And one of the questions I had was about this, you know, everyone's heard about Inflategate by now. And it made me think about all of the other people who help to run a sporting event, the ball boys, managers, all these other people who you are just always on the periphery. You never think about them. But how do you go about finding those people and ensuring that whatever rules there are for them to follow are being followed?
Well, you have Steve Zimmerman, who heads up our athletic facility area, also is the, quote, game manager. And his staff are the ones that cover all the sports. And you get assistance from the Big Ten in terms of what the protocols are. In some cases, those protocols are passed down from the NCAA. But you're right. There are a legion of people who are – back behind the scenes, from scoreboard operators to cameramen and the like. A lot of our faculty, quite frankly, help. One of the people that runs the scoring bench on women's basketball's doctors is Effie Evans, who's part of the campus. So you'll get some people like that who just are kind of engaged. In some cases, students. A lot of times you see cables being pulled out on the court for cameras and the like. They're Purdue students. So there are a lot of people behind the scenes, and everything runs smoothly for the most part. And you got hundreds of ushers, parking attendants, scoreboard operators, announcers, you name it. All the concession areas are generally manned by not-for-profits. So there's just a lot that goes into the organization of the game, and when it goes off as smoothly as it does normally, it's a credit to Steve Zimmerman and his staff.
Do you have a sense of how many volunteer people or auxiliary-type people like that it takes to run a basketball game or a football game? And I'm assuming the football game probably has a few more people.
Well,
than
you have
game.
More all of our ushers are managed through Andy Frayne. Andy Frayne's a pretty well-respected company from particularly up in the Chicago area, where they've done the Cubs for years.
So those of us who have been to Wrigley Field many times know
Andy
Frayne. Andy
Frayne. And they do a good job. And they'll hire local people. Those are all local people that will work for them. But the good thing is that many of our ushers who are in critical spots have been with us for years, so they know the patrons. So when people come in, they can get a hello, and there's more of a personal connection. I think that's positive. But I would say that in a football game, you've literally got hundreds. When you take into account parking lot attendance, concessions, all the people on the field, it's got to run into the hundreds. I've never really tried to count the number, but it's a big number.
I know that when I was going to a park in the same spot for football game coverage this past fall, I got to know the same guy who was leading me into the media lot every Saturday morning. So, yeah, you're right. You do develop those sort of relationships. We mentioned Wrigley Field real quick there, and something occurred to me this morning as I was thinking about our talks in the past about how to improve attendance and how to make people get more involved in games. And I got to thinking about the parallels between a Wrigley Field and a Ross-Ade Stadium. And it seemed to me that Wrigley Field is this unique thing where people don't go because the team is good. The team is awful almost every year. I speak as a long-suffering Cub fan. But one thing Wrigley Field has is the atmosphere. Right. People go because it's a really interesting place to watch a ball game. And I wondered if there were things that you could do to improve that buy-in from people on the atmosphere level at Mackey Arena or Ross-Ade Stadium, so that it's not as – because I don't think people are staying away from football games because the team has a couple fewer wins on the field or because there aren't as many amenities. I mean, those things play in, but there's an atmosphere thing too, I think. And I wonder how that's playing into your thinking about going forward.
Oh, it absolutely plays in, Stan, because you have different demographics today. I think there was a period of time when folks were happy to come in, sit on the bench, watch the game, and go home, tailgate before and after, and that was the extent of the experience. Now you have all kinds of game day experiences that people can opt into that'll get them out on the field before the game. People come in groups, group sales area, and they get special inside views into the stadium. So it's a much more interactive world. If you just look at what we're doing with Twitter on the boards, we're posting up Twitter feeds and the like. So you've got to find ways to interact. And I think as we do the South End Zone, that'll be top on our top on our list.
I also thought about at Duke, their basketball games, people line up outside Cameron Indoor Stadium for many hours in advance of a game, and people are constantly always on top of the other team, and it's something about the atmosphere, and you've got the beginnings of that, I think, with the paint crew in Mackey Arena. And then it's just a question of how do you expand that excitement that the student section has to the rest of the bowl.
We're going to introduce a new boiler pass this year for the students. Basically, for $99, they can go to any athletic event. And the Olympic sports are free. And the intent is to do just that. And if they, you know, for an extra $10 or $15, they join the student organization, which gives them access early, guarantees them a ticket, generally an away game, bus trip kind of activity. So those student organizations, Paint Crew is probably the most mature. You know, they've got well over 1,000 members, and they have a lot of fun. There's an organization to them, and it creates a community. And the more you can broaden that community, the more students you'll get in there. But the Boiler Pass was basically created by our students. We're going to help underwrite it a bit with some of the resources, but I think it takes ticket prices off the table. I mean, literally, if you go to 7 football games, let's say you pick another 10 or 12 basketball games, you're under $5 a ticket. And you know, so we've taken that issue off the table, and I think the students are appreciative. Didn't add anything to their student fees. And I'm going to be excited because they seem to be excited about the changes, and that's what makes college sports unique.
Well, and I think that community aspect is important because I notice when I go to basketball games, the front row seems to be the same group of 10 or 12 people in the same order every time. And when you know you're going to go and you're going to sit next to your friend as well as cheer on the team that you root for, it adds that extra little something.
Yeah, there's only one thing that I'd really like to find a kind of an alternative to. I'm not very high on the IU sucks chant. It's a hard thing to change. You don't want to dampen people's enthusiasm. But when I hear former or future employers come back to campus and they say, "What's this all about?" So somehow we've got to find a way to channel that energy in a way that doesn't diminish the brand. I know that's not their intent, and every generation has certain idiosyncrasies and use words in a certain way. I'm certainly a product of that, being from the late '60s. We were a very irreverent generation, but I don't want them to do something now that sullies the reputation in some way. And you have to be respectful of all the audiences and constituencies. So I would really like to find a way to challenge the leadership of the paint crew and the brigade to say, how could we do something that would be more of in a positive nature? And, you know, IU is always going to be the enemy. You know, I understand that. But I don't want somebody to say, boy, that's kind of boorish or cheapen the experience. So we need to work on that. I mean, I have a fair number of alums who've written me letters and are disappointed, and some think I ought to just get a microphone like Bobby Knight did and just get out and chide the students, and that's not going to work. It needs to come up through them, and I'm really going to appeal to them after the season to say, look, I don't want to ruin traditions, but if there are traditions that could be misinterpreted or in some way diminish the brand of the university, maybe we ought to rethink them and see if there are other alternatives that we can come up with. So,
well, it's not like there's not an analog with what's going on with the group of students that follows the volleyball team. We had a great story from Kristen Malavenda a couple of months ago about how the block party student group that follows the volleyball team makes a concerted effort to be relentlessly positive, to buck up the Purdue side, but not to denigrate the other side,
right.
And they have a mission statement almost about doing exactly that.
Yeah, and I know President Daniels joins me in this, and I think we want to quietly see if we can get with student leaders and say, you know, let's take the energy and amp it up double, but let's focus on our team and be positive on that. And the volleyball is a good example. So, but it's it's one when you get into that crowd mentality in any sporting event. It can be challenging, and so we're gonna work on it. I don't want the fans out there who write me letters to think we're ignoring it. On the other hand, I don't want it to get worse either. And if it looks like we're we're putting the clamps on people, then things can get worse, and we don't want that to happen.
I wanted to also get back to our talk last show about the autonomy vote. And I have having had some more time to listen back to what you had to say from a couple weeks ago and think more on it myself, I wondered if the NCAA is inadvertently running into this sort of if you give a mouse a cookie, he'll want a glass of milk type scenario, because it seems like once you start to allow some autonomy from the bigger, more wealthy schools, what's to stop them from saying, well, we'd like a little bit extra, we'd like a little bit more? It occurred to me as I was in the shower this morning, I do all my best thinking in the shower where I don't have access to a pen or pencil, that it's sort of like what happened with free agency in baseball. Mm-hmm. Marvin Miller didn't do it in one fell swoop. Right. It was little bits here and there over a number of years, and eventually there was a major sea change in how baseball and its economics operated, and I wonder if history's not about to repeat itself.
Well, I think that whole process of autonomy, there were concerns about how many areas would be allowed in, quote, the autonomy sphere. It's pretty limited. There's only about five or six areas that the group is empowered to act in, and they want to go beyond that. You have to get the board of directors' approval. The board of directors gets that whole 351, so people aren't – I think that's the check and balance that they perceive. The other thing is don't assume that everything having to do with autonomy is going to cost more money. I think, for example, the playing and practice seasons need to be examined. I'm going to pick on baseball for no good reason other than it comes to mind, but they play 56 games a year. And in a cold weather climate, it's played, generally from about March when it's freezing to May when our students we get out of class. I mean, I would like to challenge us to say, what would be wrong if we played 50 games? And if we allowed the team to play, say, the first 15 games in the fall when the weather's good, on a Sunday afternoon out at the new ballpark, would be perfect. They would count against the season, so it could get across two seasons. The beauty of that would be it takes less wear and tear on the student-athlete, less of those midweek games in the spring when they've come off a long Big Ten road trip and then they play on a Tuesday or Wednesday and they got classes. So I think it's less wear and tear there. But if you cut six games a year, it might be two or three trips that you don't have to take. So I wouldn't assume that everything is just going to be about more and more and more. That's what's in the headlines. I think the whole question of the freshman year of readiness and football and men's basketball is going to get some serious discussion in the years ahead or in the months ahead. That's not necessarily expanding benefits. It's looking at what's best for the student athlete and what's right for the collegiate model. So part of this, in my opinion, should be to allow a smaller group to maybe set the trail to create some more separation with the professional model. Now, I'm a person of one in one school, but at least with 65, you got a better chance than when you had 351. It was really hard to get those subjects up on the table for a meaningful discussion.
Well, I think, though, that the 65 schools that are getting to vote on this are, by and large, they're the schools in the biggest five conferences. They produce what I would imagine to be the lion's share of professional athletes, and these are the people who have large amounts of dollars that are spent on their athletic programs every year. And so I think you're right. I think it's not about injecting more money into the program. But nonetheless, you're talking about, by far, the most powerful group of schools you could possibly put together, I think, in the NCAA. And, I mean, what stops them at some point from saying, we don't necessarily need these strictures that the NCAA is putting on us anymore. We can go and form our own division, and there's already 65 of us.
I think if autonomy hadn't been granted, that could have been a real possibility. Because I think the 65 were the 65 schools that were being attacked. If you remember in one of the earlier shows, I said there were four forces that were operating today. There's a series of court cases, there's Congress, there's the changes in the NCAA governance system, and then you have a public that's increasingly cynical. All four of those things are interacting right now. And I think if we hadn't gotten autonomy, for example, we were able to give them a full scholarship by voting in the cost of attendance this past January. Well, that was one of the complaints through some of the court cases, that we weren't really giving them a full scholarship. So without being a smaller group to be able to react, all the schools weren't being sued. It's the bigger schools that are being sued. So we can't adapt. I don't like to see us react to court cases. I think we need to take care of our own business and try to create some separation, particularly in those two sports, in football and men's basketball, and recognize that when you're taking an 18-year-old, bringing him in here, asking him to get adjusted to college courses, asking him to try to get on the field, deal with the media, all the other obligations of students, it's a lot. And you talk about the potential for exploitation or using people. It seems to me that people who are on that line of thinking are spot on. And it should cause people like presidents and athletic directors to stand back and say, is that really what we want? And I think you can, if a young person gets off to a good start in their freshman year academically, I think they'll do a good job throughout their college career. I think most faculty would say that. And it's true of all students, not just student athletes. And I look at the amount of pressure that's put on a freshman football player and basketball player, and I said, geez, wouldn't a year of readiness? Guarantee them 5 years. Give them a year of readiness where you can have a personalized plan to deal with their academic development, their physical development, their social development. So you're not taking a benefit away. You're probably adding a benefit, if you will. But at the end of the day, it avoids the exploitation. If a youngster doesn't want to come to campus because it's going to deprive them of the opportunity to go pro in year two, okay, go pro out of high school. You know, Kevin Durant, LeBron James did it. But if you're going to come, you ought to come with the expectation you're going to sit a year. You can practice, but you're not going to travel. And it's a year of assimilation. It would be the most important thing we could do to create some separation between the collegiate model and professional model. It's not necessary in every sport. We have to get away from saying, well, if you do it in one sport, No, these two sports have got a spotlight on them that makes it very, very pressure-packed. I mean, I've seen our teams in football and basketball, and you look at those freshmen and you go, man, what would I have been like at 18 to deal with that pressure? Got media this day, I got weights, I got my academic stuff, I got the – it's just a crushing schedule that we're putting on these kids. And as a parent and now as an athletic director, I think we're putting too much on them. Then we see aberrant behavior. Now, whether there's a cause or effect, I don't know. But when you see kids do something silly, you know, it could be a sexual assault, it could be a substance abuse issue, you wonder if that's not a release against the pressure and the tension. Because we're taking them from high school to the big stage, and we're doing it almost overnight. And I think it's really hard. And I can see where people think we're abusing and exploiting. So those kinds of issues are really meaty. They're a little expensive, because you'd have to add some scholarships on the men's side, and I think, to be fair, do it on the women's side. But at the end of the day, if we're going to spend money, the amount of money we're spending, let's spend it to educate people and prepare them for the next generation. They're not all going to play pro. They know it. But they all hold out that hope, and they should, that they'll have that dream. But we're being unfair, I think, to those two sports, and we need to deal with that issue this year and have a serious debate about it.
You mentioned possibly having a five-year guarantee, and that sort of dovetails with something else I was thinking about this week is, I've worked on a college campus for a number of years now, and I always try to get involved with intramural sports whenever I can. And I was thinking about the athletes, and there are, of course, rules that keep me, thankfully, from ever having to be guarded by Rafael Davis because he'd make me look silly.
Most of us.
But I wondered about the extracurricular activities that the athletes can be involved in, because as you point out, there is so much that goes into training to be a Division I college athlete. Do you have the ability to be involved with many student groups or to be a part of a Greek house or something like that?
Not as much as you'd like. And I think that's another issue that will get debated this year on the time demands, not only the playing and practice season that I mentioned, but also the amount of preparation. And each sport's a little different, but each sport has what I'm going to call a preparation or training stage. It has a competition stage, and it has a recovery stage. Your body needs to recover. So all those are a little bit different. So a distance runner is much different than a volleyball player. So you need to be sports specific. I think if you were to do that, you might open up a little bit of time. I think there's a point of diminishing returns, both in terms of physical practice and in terms of mental demands, watching film and the like. We need to find a way to cut back. But I would really want to engage student athletes who are at the elite level, coaches, and probably exercise physiologists to design a sport-specific model and come up with something that makes some sense. If you do that, I think there is time if they manage their time well. So what do I mean by that? Let's say a student athlete has a class at 8:30 and 11:30. If they go back to their residence hall or back to the to their apartment and sleep every day, they're cutting 2 hours off the evening that they could have done something else. So they've got to use that time wisely. And we spend an enormous amount of time early in their college career, both between the college academic advisors and their athletic academic advisors, really teaching time management and showing that, you know, you think you're busy, but look at the amount of waste in your day because you're not being organized and efficient in your time use. So there's a little bit on them. There's a little bit on us. I found something interesting just the other day. I think the first Cambridge Award, is like the, what's the other great student national award?
Rhodes Scholarship?
Yeah.
Something like that?
Yeah, something like that. But the Cambridge Fellowship is like a Rhodes Scholar. I think it's the second most prominent. Purdue's first finalist was Carly Marshall, who's a woman swimmer. So there are some people who are very, very good at managing their time to get things, but the overwhelming majority probably are swamped, and we need to kind of look at that. On the other hand, they do form a fraternity or sorority in themselves because they do get to know each other. And one of the benefits is many of your teams are very diverse. It could be racial, could be international students. I think that's good for them too. I think we are much more tolerant of differences within athletics than people who are more insulated in certain areas of the campus.
It strikes me that your model of the three stages is particularly applicable to academics as well, because if you think about studying for a test, you've got the cramming the night before, mm-hmm. or hopefully in the weeks leading up to the test, you've got the test itself, the performance phase, and then you've got the recovery of, oh, boy, am I glad that's done. And so the model is you've got the same model, but you've got it applied in two different ways for student athletes, and you've got to figure out how to intertwine those couple of things.
And we've been, since I've been doing this job, we've had really great success working with the faculty. And our student athletes, at the beginning of each semester, take a letter, old-fashioned letter, where they've got to give it to the faculty member. And it shows their schedule for the upcoming semester, and the idea is for them to have a discussion with their professor early on in the semester about here are the challenges I'm going to face from a scheduling perspective. I would say that 99% of the faculty, as long as the young person is respectful and they work hard, the faculty member will bend over backwards to try to accommodate them. So, you know, we've actually had exams proctored on the road according to university protocols and the like. People have been given a ability to take a final exam early in order to do a competition later in a week. They've been very accommodating, which is we're very appreciative of it.
I've seen that happen. I've gone to classes to talk to students about possible internships at WBAA and seen athletes mm-hmm. walk up to the professor and have a conversation. Let me ask you about the other side of that, which is, I remember from my own collegiate experience, it felt like every semester there was one week somewhere along the line that, like, all of my professors decided this was the week that we're going to have all of the big tests or all of the big oral exams or whatever. If a student athlete comes up against that, is there any sort of accommodation that can be made from a team to that athlete to say, we recognize academics comes first?
Absolutely. And it may not be an entire team. It may be a segment of the team, but it's not at all unusual for a coach to say, look, I want you out of here today. You've got a busy week. It's not unusual at all. The coaches understand that they're here to set these kids up to be successful in the classroom. And part of their compensation and part of their reward system is tied to setting the atmosphere that will create the best possible academic outcome. So no doubt the coaches are, you know, if you are deprive a kid of an opportunity to go home and study for a test, how well do you think they're going to compete for you? I mean, it doesn't stand to reason, does it? So I think there's a sensitivity. Now, the key thing is being organized. If something catches up with that's why we get their plan. We give them a planner in the beginning of the year, old-fashioned planners. But, you know, whether it be a mortarboard, ours is like a mortarboard. It's just a little bigger. And just to get them in the habit of going into their syllabus is one of the first things we teach them is in that freshman class. Is to manage that schedule.
All right. Well, Morgan, thanks as always. Great to talk with you, and we'll do it again in a couple of weeks.
Great. Thanks very much, Dan.
And if ever you've got a question for Purdue Athletics Director Morgan Burke for our show Off the Field, you can email that to news@wbaa.org, or you can tweet your questions @WBAA News on Twitter. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Have a good rest of your day.